You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV. You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Welcome back, viewers and listeners, to another episode of Blogging Heads Foreign Entanglements. Today, we'll be shining a spotlight on the Southeast Asian state of Malaysia. It's a state of 31 million people of Malay, Chinese, and Indian heritages, with a number of religions practiced, including Islam, Christianity, Hinduism, and Buddhism. But as we'll find out, it's actually quite an important state within the regional grouping, and it has an important role to play within Southeast Asian security and foreign policy matters. My guest today is Alina Noor. She's Director of Foreign Policy and Security Studies at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Alina, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Alina, let's just start with a little bit about your background. Can you tell us a little bit about the previous roles you've had and how you find yourself now in security studies?
My background is actually in international law, and I specialized in the international laws of war, looking to join an international court of justice. Unfortunately, that didn't pan out because I didn't have the money to do internships in foreign exotic places where conflicts were happening. So I ended up at a think tank in Washington, D.C., working on weapons of mass destruction terrorism. Around the time that I was ending my internship, the rise of Jamaat Islamiyah was taking place in Southeast Asia. And so I returned to Malaysia to join the institute that I'm at now, ISIS Malaysia, to work on counterterrorism issues.
Right.
And I've been here ever since.
Excellent. And of course, you and I have met in Malaysia and in Singapore and other countries as well, working on Southeast Asian issues. Now, I just wanted to start a little bit about Malaysia. I think many of our viewers won't be as acquainted with Malaysia when people think Southeast Asia. In particular, I mean, Southeast Asia has been in the news because of the Philippines and the Vietnam's territorial struggles with China. So Malaysia takes a little bit of a backseat, but let's just start with an overview of Malaysia's foreign policy and strategic posture.
Sure. You know, Malaysia, as you and everybody else in this industry knows, is a small, pragmatic country in terms of how it conducts its foreign policy. And that means adhering to international rules, international norms, and international laws. Malaysia has always, since the first prime minister, taken a non-aligned stance. I mean, that has shifted somewhat based on pragmatism of the country's administration. But by and large, Malaysia has remained neutral and has refused to take alliances, although we have strong partnerships with many countries, some of whom don't often see eye to eye with each other. In Malaysia, we have noticed a number of political shifts in our relationships with major powers. I think the most prominent has been Malaysia's relationship with the United States. Particularly during Tuan Dr. Mahathir's time, we saw some political lows with the United States. But at the operational level, the working relationship was really still very solid. And even as Dr. Mahathir was lobbying all sorts of criticism and rhetoric at his U.S. counterpart, there was still a meeting that was sought with the White House, despite all that. So at the working level, we've always maintained good relations with as many countries as possible, even if at the diplomatic and political level, things have been rather different.
It's interesting. My thinking is some of that has come out of Malaysia's experience of being a colonized country and having had the British, steering and directing. And maybe it's now that as an independent state, Malaysia is trying to kind of navigate its way and have its own identity. To what extent do its Commonwealth roots have any bearing on its foreign policy?
The Commonwealth still remains relevant. A lot of people think it's just about the sociocultural, educational aspect. But in reality, you know, we talked about the 5 hours offensive arrangement, and that's still very relevant for Malaysia, particularly in these changing strategic times. So we have that, and we have remaining good relations, the defense and security level with all of those countries, particularly those closest to us, such as Australia.
Yes, so the five-power defence arrangement, of course, is comprising of Britain, New Zealand, Australia, Singapore, and Malaysia. So it's a bit of an eclectic bunch, though. Do you think it still remains relevant today, even though Britain is very, very far away? I mean, does it still, should it still play a role in security?
Yeah, I mean, Britain has been trying to reinvent its relevance in this region, and particularly with Malaysia. I think you see Britain's cooperation on the defense and security front evolve from traditional security issues to non-traditional security issues. And the British footprint in Malaysia in cybersecurity issues in particular is really starting to grow in this country.
Well, that's very interesting. Actually, we'll swing back and talk about security threats to Malaysia. Just want to press ahead a little bit more with Malaysia's foreign policy contours. So the Commonwealth playing a lesser extent, but another element of Malaysia's identity, of course, is that it has a large Muslim population. To what extent does its Muslim identity in part play a bearing on its foreign policy issues? And to what extent does it shape its position on Palestine and Israel?
I think in the past, Malaysia was a prominent member of the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Conference. And I think Malaysia's non-aligned role was particularly useful during the nuclear standoff with Iran that many of the major powers, Western major powers, had. And Malaysia, I think, was seen as a very useful bridge because where those countries could not speak directly to Iran, Malaysia, which had, you know, been able to speak to many other countries, including Iran, could use its diplomatic skills to convey messages back and forth. And typically, you know, Malaysia also had good relations with Saudi. It'll be interesting to see now with the Saudi-Iran split, how Malaysia's role in between will be used to further its diplomatic relations with both countries. But in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, there is a certain religious element to it. I think there is this feeling of brotherhood among Muslims in Malaysia for the oppression that has been suffered by the Palestinians at the hands of Israeli occupation. It's important, though, to note that it's not only Muslims in Malaysia who feel the sense of injustice, but it's also shared among many of the non-Muslims in Malaysia. Because, you know, as I mentioned, the question of Palestinian and the occupation of their territories is really a question of a violation of international law, and at its heart, a question of a violation of justice. So I think while there is a certain religious element to it, it's also, you know, very much rooted in fundamental aspects of how human beings are allowed to live their lives in dignity.
That's very interesting. With those domestic influences in mind, how does Malaysia's foreign policy actually manifest with regards to Israel then?
Malaysia has not had diplomatic relations with Israel. We still do not have diplomatic relations with Israel. This has become a bit of a complication where Malaysia has hosted international sporting tournaments where Israeli participants have been expected. And so in the recent past, we've seen our sports minister, youth and sports minister, taking the cue from Malaysia's diplomatic stance and banning Israeli participation in some of these sporting events. Now, this has elicited some pushback from some of these international organizations ruling over those sports. But unfortunately, I think the sports minister has to follow whatever diplomatic position Malaysia takes.
I see. I mean, there's obviously the other element of Malaysia being a Southeast Asian nation that gives so much, I think, structure and framework to a lot of its foreign policy. The Association for Southeast Asian Nations is an important grouping for Malaysia, and we both know that it was chair of that grouping last year. What does being the chair of ASEAN actually give Malaysia diplomatically, or what responsibilities does it have in that regard?
I think last year was a particularly important time for ASEAN because 2015 was meant to be the year when ASEAN was supposed to have sewn up its community, right, the establishment of its community. And so when we were heading into 2015, there were a lot of expectations for Malaysia to come up with new and dramatic initiatives. Because if you remember 10 years ago when Malaysia was chair, the government came up with this idea of having an East Asia summit. And so there were questions about whether Malaysia would try to replicate some of the initiative like that. And I think the Malaysian government kind of toned down expectations from the get-go and said, we're just going to try and sew up loose ends, tie up loose ends, so that the community can be declared at the end of the year. Now, I don't think there was any doubt that the community wasn't going to be declared at the end of the year, but there were some real action lines that needed to be accomplished. And I think Malaysia's position was that it would try to get as many of those, in terms of percentage, action lines accomplished and successfully accomplished by the end of the year. So I think we've come a long way in terms of our sub-communities, the AEC, ASEAN Economic Community, ASEAN Political and Security Community, as well as the ASEAN Sociocultural Community. But obviously, there will be more work to be done.
Yeah, sure. Just to recap, I think the major deliverable from the end of last year was obviously that the AEC, the Economic Community, was signed off. And that obviously means that it's easier to trade within the region, lowering of tariffs and a greater movement of goods. ASEAN always is criticized as a slow-moving vehicle where there's a principle of consensus and non-interference. And obviously, I think this has become a very important issue when we're looking in terms of instruments like the Code of Conduct for the South China Sea with China. I think, that has still not been completed.
Right.
Where are we at with the Code of Conduct right now?
We keep hearing from officials that the process is moving on. Unfortunately, that process is being outpaced by realities on the ground, or at sea, rather. And there's been a lot of criticism that the COC will not have enough bite.
Do you think a code of conduct will actually do anything? And do you think Malaysia could have achieved it?
You know, I think while a code of conduct is preferable to no code of conduct, and I think the DOC itself has already been violated, if not in spirit, if not in action, then certainly in spirit.
And that's because the declaration.
The declaration of the code of conduct. Because there are a number of items on there that have already, been surpassed by some of the developments that have taken place recently, such as the militarization that's going on Woody Island, for example.
Yes, all rather concerning stuff. So just getting back to Malaysia's position on the South China Sea, Malaysia, obviously the South China Sea comprises of multiple overlapping claims by Southeast Asian states and China and other actors, but in this particular instance, the ones that are gaining the most attention are those between China, the Philippines, China and Vietnam. Of course, Malaysia has claims with other Southeast Asian states like Indonesia. But given that Malaysia is not a direct claimant to any of China's claims, how does Malaysia respond to all of the recent tensions that have gone on there? How does Malaysia respond to, for instance, the land reclamation activities?
Malaysia does not have any direct claims with China and the Paracels, at least. And I think we're seeing more focus on the Philippines and Vietnam because obviously geographically they're closer to China and have to deal with this more urgently. But I think Malaysia has seen a number of instances where the government is increasingly feeling like China is pushing the envelope with its friendship with Malaysia in the South China Sea. We saw, for example, in 2013, the issue with James Shoal, and also since 2013, the issue of a Chinese vessel anchored off South Laconia Shoal, all within the EEZ of Malaysia. So Malaysia has been criticized for being spineless, for not taking enough action, for not facing up enough to a more assertive China. But I think we're at this point where we need to consolidate differing voices within the Malaysian government and try to figure out an approach or next steps that will adequately respond to some of these moves that we're seeing from China in the South China Sea, and particularly in our surrounding waters.
Is it a friendship, actually? Could you actually call the relationship between China and Malaysia a friendship?
I think, Malaysia is better friends with China than, say, for example, some of the other disputing countries in the South China Sea. At one point, I think at the Track 2 level, we would call it China's best friend. Malaysia is a comprehensive strategic partner with China. as of 2013. And, you know, like many countries in the region, China is Malaysia's number one trading partner. So the economic relationship is very, very strong. The defense and security relationship is only just taking off, and it's comparatively new to some of the defense relations that we've had with other countries in the region. So I think we're trying to hold on to that friendship, but increasingly we're seeing strains in the South China Sea. And so that's an element, I think, that we're concerned about, even though the larger context of the Malaysia-China relationship is still quite strong.
With those kinds of provocative acts, the Lekunen Shoal issues, where China is pushing the friendship, you say, has Malaysia reached out to any other partners in order to diversify its strategic partnerships?
My understanding is that with some of these recent moves by China, Malaysia has sent diplomatic notes on a regular basis, protest notes to China. And so I think the preference has been to deal with this behind the scenes. Because it's better for all parties involved, particularly China and Malaysia. But I think Malaysia has always, again, you know, reached out to other partners. And so even if we seem to be reaching out even more to some of our other partners, it's only because the quality of those ties need to be deepened. I mean, for example, the United States. You know, we have had a defense and security relationship with them since the 1960s. And over time, quite independently of other factors, including China, both countries have sought to deepen the quality of the military relationship. So it might be because of China, but it's not all about China.
I see. What about Japan, countries like Japan, India, Russia, Australia? Have there been any changes in their strategic relationships with Malaysia?
I think there have been exploratory opportunities, particularly with Japan, India and Russia less so, but, you know, we've always also dealt with them at the defense and security level. So I think Malaysia is very welcoming of working with as many partners as possible. It's, you know, our classic foreign policy and defense conduct. We try to be friends with everyone, not antagonize anyone. And I think the government has always been very wary of the ulterior motives of some of these partners who come in at full force because of, you know, whatever tensions they might have with some of their neighbours.
We talked a little bit earlier about Malaysia's interests in the Middle East. I want to come back now to the issue of Islamic State and terrorism and talk a little bit about threats to Malaysia. To what extent at the moment is Malaysia involved or interested in military operations there? And really, to what extent is terrorism something that Malaysians have to think about nowadays?
Well, as you know, that terrorism is not a new issue for Malaysia. I think it's just more prominent now because of social media and technology. And so in the past, you know, the police had always been very low-key in stumping some of these attempts by terrorists. And this has taken place over the decade, at least. It's just that Malaysians were not aware of what was going on. But now I think because the threat is slightly more urgent, because of the changing nature of terrorism, there is concern that these foreign fighters might return, or rather Malaysian fighters in Syria, might return to sow problems in Malaysia. Again, this is not new, but I think the nature of brutality has changed, as well as the speed and pace of recruitment. So I think there is a very urgent concern among the authorities on how to stem these trends. In the past, any military action that Malaysia was involved in was under the umbrella of the UN. It seems now, though, that Malaysia has signed on to the Saudi-led military coalition against terrorism. This is a new development. It's certainly a striking development for watchers like myself.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
And it's not it's not quite clear, you know, exactly what operations this coalition will be involved in. In the past, we've heard that Malaysia will only be involved in humanitarian actions within this coalition, and that there won't be direct military involvement. If any, I think Malaysia will play a supporting role. But it seems that that position is changing. So I'm not quite certain which direction we're headed in as a country involved in this coalition. And I think there are real consequences to think about for Malaysia's participation in this coalition.
I mean, I have to ask, why? Why do you think now is the time for Malaysia to start softening its non-aligned stance?
I'm not certain exactly what drivers are really behind this decision to participate in this coalition. We haven't been given an official explanation, and I'd prefer not to speculate. I don't buy the idea that terrorism in its current form is a real catalyst for our participation. We've always had this problem. It's just a different form now. And I'm not quite certain why we've decided to participate in a military coalition.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to see how that unfolds, and we'll see how what else that does in terms of Malaysia's stance. I want to come back a little bit now to other kinds of threats. I know cyber is an area that you look at. Walk me through a little bit of what the kinds of non-traditional threats there are, including cyber, to Malaysia today.
The cyber threat is still quite nascent in this country. It's mostly cyber crimes that Malaysia is facing. So things like malware, different forms of both attempted and actual intrusions into our systems. But I think the government has actually been quite proactive in trying to bolster defenses for our critical infrastructure in this country. And there have been a number of cyber drills, interagency cyber drills, that the government has taken part in and actually initiated. So I think that demonstrates a good amount of readiness and preparedness amongst government agencies. The real test will be when something actually happens. I think what is sorely lacking, though, is the policy contemplation of, you know, strategic, what I call strategic cybersecurity. So issues like how states can and should interact in cyberspace. There is a lot of discussion now, particularly among the more developed countries, about whether international law should figure into how states interact with each other in cyberspace. This is not a discussion that's being participated in by many of the ASEAN countries, Malaysia included. And I think there's sort of a misconception that this is a big power issue and that small countries don't really have a stake in this, which is completely untrue.
Of course.
The cyber domain affects us all. And, you know, my argument is that if countries like Malaysia don't take an active role in this unfolding discussion now, then at the end of the day, we're going to just have to acquiesce to whatever rules have been crystallized by the time we're ready to come to the negotiating table.
That's really interesting. So Malaysia's taken a lot of steps as well domestically to address security issues. I think last year it introduced a national security bill as well that received a little bit of criticism. Can you just walk me through some of the main elements of that national security bill? And to what extent is that a response to these kinds of threats, or is that directed towards other elements, other issues?
The National Security Council bill, interestingly, was passed through both houses and parliament. And some have said that it was passed at astounding speed through both houses of parliament. I think what's significant is that the Council of Rulers in Malaysia has taken a look at this bill and advised for the bill to be refined, which is quite unprecedented, which suggests that there are indeed some worrying elements of the bill. And so the government will have to review and perhaps tweak a few elements within the bill to make it more palatable to the Council of Rulers. Now, this does not mean that the bill will not be gazetted and made into a full-fledged act. But I think the fact that the rulers, who are usually above political debate, have chosen to say something about it says something about the situation in the country, and particularly with the act. The act itself, despite its controversies, is actually mainly to coordinate among the differing agencies, because we've seen a lack of this coordination in times of crises, such as the floods in 2014 in the east coast of Malaysia. So there has always been a National Security Council. What the bill provides is for the declaration of a security area wherein parliamentary democracy will not have to be suspended, but emergency-like powers can come into play and agencies can coordinate better amongst each other without the bureaucratic processes that would govern otherwise.
I think we'll leave unsaid what some of the concerns with that kind of activity could be, but I think obviously some of the justification for that has also been terrorism, amongst other things.
Yes.
Yes.
Terrorism is one, but and I think this bill was really born of the Lahad Datu insurgency in 2013, which was really quite unprecedented for this country in recent times. And so you saw a bit of chaos taking place between the agencies that were involved. So I think the hope with this bill is that should something like that ever occur again, there would be better coordination. Now, having said that, I think the controversies surrounding the bill have to do with the concentration of powers in the executive and a lack of a solid review, judicial review of some of those elements within the bill. There are checks and balances within the bill, surprisingly, I think to many of us. But I think a lot of the criticism surrounding the bill has to do with really the political developments that have unfolded in this country.
Interesting. It seems to me like Malaysia's got a lot of things to work out domestically as well, but it definitely has a role to play in the foreign policy arena. I would like to see it step up a little bit more and enforce international law, I'm sure, as you would too. So, Alina, before we sign off, I would just like to ask you, as a researcher, obviously, we have our inspiration day in, day out when we're working from one researcher to another. Are there any kinds of music you would like to recommend that gets you in the right in the right analysis headspace?
I don't know if this would really be politically correct. I'm a big hip-hop fan.
Yes, absolutely. Best answer.
I love your think tank Thug Life. That's a bit of a mouthful, but I love that motto, and I completely identify with it. I'm a big hip-hop, rap, R&B girl, so that's what I usually listen to.
Awesome. All right. I think we'll have to switch notes another time.
And playlists, yes.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Alina, thank you so much again for making time to talk to us about Malaysia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
To all our viewers and our listeners, thank you very much for joining us. You can catch the rest of our episodes at bloggingheads.tv or via your podcast apps. You can also catch more of Alina's tweets and research at her Twitter handle at ELINANOR. OOR, that's at Alina Noor. And we look forward to having her again to talk about developments in Malaysian foreign policy. And until then, we'll see you next time.
You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV. Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.